I heard it said in a conference on devotion one time, and I'm pretty sure it was from Father Ripperger, that the saints are individuals and they're not monolithic. They have likes and dislikes, and some saints favor some people over others. As a result, one person can have a devotion to a particular saint, and anything they pray for, they get. Another person can pray to the same saint and get nothing. And I think this is true. Now, don't worry, you'll find your saints, those whom God has assigned to help you, or rather, they will find you. But before we get into all of this, let's briefly defend saintly intercession for any Protestants who may be watching and saying to themselves, "Why can't you just go to Jesus?" For them, I suggest they watch my video titled, "Why Can't You Just Go to Jesus?" But in a nutshell, the word pray doesn't mean worship. It means to make a request. This is evident in the King James Version of the Bible, for instance, Isaiah 29:11, "And the vision of all is becoming unto you as the words of a book that is sealed, which men deliver to one that is learned, saying, 'Read this, I pray thee,' and he saith, 'I cannot, for it is sealed.'" This talks about men asking one who is learned to read a scroll for them, and the word used for making the request is pray. When we quote, pray to saints, we are asking them to pray for us and our intentions, just like all Christians ask other Christians to pray for them and their intentions. Because guess what? The saints are Christians too. The church is on earth and in heaven. The book of Revelation speaks of angels and saints in heaven delivering our prayers to God. And prayers to saints are written on the walls of the catacombs dating back to the earliest centuries. So we know the early Christians practiced intercessory prayer to the saints. And before you accuse us of, quote, conjuring the dead is an attempt to communicate with a deceased person, have a conversation, if you will. That's not what this is. Besides, Jesus said the saints are alive, Matthew 22:31-32. "And as for the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what was said to you by God? I am the God of Abraham, and the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living." You might say, why not just ask a living person to pray for you? Well, we do, but the Bible says that the prayers of the righteous are powerful, and since nothing unclean can enter heaven, those whom God has revealed to the Catholic Church are indeed in heaven, are the most righteous. I don't know how righteous you and your friends are. Besides, anyone who practices intercessory prayer with the saints knows it's very powerful. If I lose something, St. Anthony is Johnny on the spot. If I'm looking for something and I can't find it, I sit down, say a prayer to St. Anthony, and I'll get an inclination to look in some crazy spot, and sure enough, there it is. Or my eye will just catch whatever I'm looking for. One time my son called me in a panic because he had to be somewhere and he could not find his keys. He looked, quote, everywhere. I told him to ask St. Anthony for help. He called me back 10 minutes later and told me that after praying to the saint, he got the urge to pick up the love seat, turn it upside down, and shake it, which he did, and the keys eventually fell out. He had checked the love seat several times, but the keys were too deep for him to feel. One more story about St. Anthony. I do a haunted walkthrough in my garage every year for Halloween. I take the week before off of work to build props and set up the displays. One year, I needed a fog machine for a new prop I was making. I already had one, but it was being used for something else. It was a few days from Halloween, and I looked everywhere for one. I went to several Walmarts, Target, Party City, Lowe's, and they were all out. I even went to Spirit, and they were out. As a last-ditch effort, I tried Menards. I went to their small Halloween display and saw nothing. So I wandered across the store, wondering what to do. Now, I had already prayed to St. Anthony about this, but at this point, I pleaded again. I looked back at the Halloween area from across the store and saw a box on a lower shelf that was pushed back deep into the shelf. I went back to see what it was, and sure enough, it was a fog machine, the last one. Because it was so far back on the shelf, no one saw it. When I was in my late 20s, recently divorced, longtime separated, marriage annulled, of course, broke, having my truck repossessed and living with my parents, knowing my previous marriage was not valid even without an annulment, I wanted to get married for real. So I said a novena to St. Anthony, St. Rita, and St. Jude to find my real wife. A few months later, we met on a blind date, and 2 months after that, we were married. It's been 25 years. That's how I know God put us together, despite the fact that she's a Protestant. Not that I would suggest a Catholic marry a Protestant, or that you should marry someone after knowing them only 2 months. We are the exception, not the norm. And some may say it's so she will convert, or that God knows being married to me will cause her to eventually convert. That hasn't happened yet, but sure, that could be why. I know if she's on her deathbed before me, she will have a priest there. After my first grandchild was born, I desperately wanted her to be baptized. I tried for a year to get it arranged, only to be told I couldn't do it because she was not my child. My daughter and her husband were both lapsed Catholics, and although they agreed to it, they wanted me to do the legwork. Finally, I gave up and said a novena to St. Monica, which ended on her feast day, and I attended Mass in her honor. Somehow, my millennial daughter and her husband got their act together, and my granddaughter was baptized within 2 months of ending the novena. So that's my prayer team, Anthony, Jude, Monica, and Rita, and St. Margaret of Cortona, but I'm not going to tell that story. And I would love to add Joan of Arc. There are a few figures in Western history more impressive than Joan of Arc. She was a teenage peasant girl who led the French army to several victories over the English with odds heavily stacked against them. Everything about the situation goes against the societal norms of the time. She was a female. Females don't fight in war. She was a peasant, the lowest in the societal totem pole, so to speak, and peasants don't lead, they follow. And she was a teenager. Catholics, Protestants, even secularists and atheists have a profound respect for Joan of Arc. I don't agree with the sentiment, but even the gender-fluid crowd admires her for challenging the gender roles of the time. And although I have a deep admiration, love, and respect for Joan of Arc, I must admit I don't pray to her like I do other saints. Not because I don't want to, but because when I do, she never answers my prayers. And I think I know why. You see, when it comes to the Hundred Years' War, my sympathies are with the English, and I think she knows that. Now, this video is a bit tongue-in-cheek, but it is true. She doesn't answer my prayers, and I am sympathetic to the English when it comes to the Hundred Years' War. That's not to say that I believe Joan was wrong. I believe she was sent by God and that God said no to the English. But when it comes to the story of Joan of Arc, people have a tendency to believe that the English arbitrarily decided to invade and conquer France for no good reason. And that's not true. They had a very good reason. But to explain why I believe the English were justified in their invasion of France requires a little background. History is fluid, and oftentimes the cause of an event can be a series of other events going back several centuries, and in this case we need to start with William the Conqueror. He was the Duke of Normandy and a vassal under the French king who in 1066 AD invaded and conquered England, establishing himself as king. William also deposed the Anglo-Saxon nobility, setting up a Norman nobility in its place. In 1154, Henry Plantagenet, Duke of Normandy, married Eleanor, Duchess of Aquitaine. Aquitaine was a vast region of southwest France. Eleanor's father died without a male heir, and Eleanor, being the oldest daughter, inherited the duchy, which meant that her husband would become the duke. Henry would become Henry II, King of England. England, plus the regions of France as well as parts of Ireland and Wales, owned by the Plantagenets, is known as the Angevin Empire. All of this sets up a strange situation where the King of England is the sovereign of his own kingdom while simultaneously a vassal to the French king due to his ownership of French lands, which amounted to approximately half of the French kingdom. As you can imagine, this situation did not sit well with either king. The English kings did not like the fact that they had to swear fealty to the French kings, and the French kings did not like the fact that one of their vassals owned half of the kingdom and was king of his own separate kingdom. This situation resulted in war between England and France periodically over these lands, which always seemed to result in a treaty signed in which the King of England would marry the French king's daughter. This results in the two royal houses being very closely related, and this is the situation leading up to the Hundred Years' War. Now, the term Hundred Years' War is a bit misleading. It wasn't one continuous war, but rather a series of wars, and it lasted a little over 100 years. It's important to note that by the time we get to the Hundred Years' War, Bad King John, you know, of Robin Hood fame, had lost almost all of the English territories in France. By the time the conflicts began, the English territories were reduced to Gascony, a small territory of Aquitaine. To resolve tensions between England and France, Philip of France married his daughter Isabella to King Edward II of England in 1303 AD. Their son would become King Edward III of England. Isabella's brother became King of France, but died without a male heir. Edward III, his nephew, was the closest male relative, but the French had no desire to be ruled by the King of England, so they decided that the crown could not pass through the female line, thus excluding Edward, and the crown was given to the deceased king's cousin, Philip, Count of Valois. Edward didn't care at this point. He was young, he had just taken power as King of England, and he didn't want the responsibility of another kingdom. So he swore fealty to the new French king. And that should have been it. But the new French king wasn't done with Edward. He signed an alliance with Scotland against England. He banned the import of English wool. And using the pretext that Edward was an unfit vassal, King Philip attacked Gascony, the last of the French lands owned by England, and claimed it for himself. And while Gascony was a relatively small territory, it had a rich wine production, which England would no longer benefit from. France threatened England militarily with the agreement with Scotland and economically with the ban of wool and the taking of Gascony. So Edward proclaimed himself the rightful king of France and invaded. Thus began the Hundred Years' War in 1337. Over the course of the next just over a century, kings on both sides came and went, as did peace agreements. The war was fairly lopsided in favor of England, thanks to the longbow, though the French would regain territory from time to time. Conventional medieval warfare consisted of rival armies lining up on opposite sides of the battlefield. The cavalry and infantry would charge at each other as the archers lofted arrows from short bows. The nobility stayed back out of harm's way. But the longbow gave the English a huge advantage. It was able to be shot much farther than the short bow, enabling the English bowmen to pick off most of the opposing army before they ever reached the English army. And a fair amount of nobles who thought they were safe were killed by longbowmen as well. An army of less than 10,000 easily decimated armies of 20 and 30,000. But it was the English king Henry V who would win a decisive victory at the Battle of Agincourt in 1415. The French king named Henry his successor, disinheriting the current successor, his son, the Dauphin, and of course, gave his daughter for Henry to marry. Both kings died within a year, but Henry had a son with the French king's daughter, Henry VI, who inherited both thrones. And while there were pockets of resistance that supported the Dauphin, for all intents and purposes, it was over. Even the church accepted this. So at the age of 7, Henry was crowned King of England in London, and on his 9th birthday, he was crowned King of France at Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. And according to all human reason, it was just. Edward had, in my opinion, the strongest claim to the French throne. He was provoked into claiming it. Henry V became the rightful heir to the French throne by right of conquest, and that right was being passed on to his son. Yet God had other plans. In fact, by the time Henry was crowned in Paris in 1431, the tide was already turning against English control, thanks to a teenage peasant girl named Joan, who claimed to have visions of various saints, who told her that she would lead the French army against the English to reinstate the rightful king of France, the Dauphin. So she went to the Dauphin to tell him this. And even though she had never met him before and did not know what he looked like, she was able to pick him out amongst the nobles, even though he was dressed more common than they were, in order to test her. She then talked to him in private and was able to tell him things that no one would know except God. So he agreed to let her lead the army. To what extent she led the army versus merely being a figurehead is debatable. But with Joan, the French army fought many victories, including Orleans and Pathé, allowing the French to advance to Reims. Because you see, the French king is not crowned in Paris. He's crowned in Reims, where the Frankish King Clovis, the first Christian king, was baptized and crowned, the very birthplace of Christendom itself. And so, in 1429, Charles the Dauphin and rightful heir to the French throne was crowned King of France in Reims with Joan by his side, showing France that he, not Henry, was the true King of France. Of course, we all know what happened to Joan after her unsuccessful siege of Paris and La Charette. Her favor started to wane with the French court. She organized a company of volunteers to relieve Compiègne, which had been besieged by the Burgundians, French allies of the English, but she was captured by the Burgundians on the 23rd of May. They offered to ransom Joan to her ally, King Charles, whom she fought to get crowned in Reims, but he declined. So she was handed over to the English. She was put on trial by Bishop Pierre Cochon on accusation of heresy, including blaspheming by wearing men's clothes, acting upon visions that were demonic, and refusing to submit her words and deeds to the judgment of the church. She was declared guilty and burned at the stake on May 30th, 1431, at the age of 19. And while she was captured and killed before Henry was crowned in Paris, her legend and actions inspired the French, leading to their eventual victory in the Hundred Years' War decades later. Joan's trial was later reopened by the Inquisition on July 7, 1456. The original trial, judged to be invalid due to improper procedures, deceit, and fraud, and the charges against Joan were nullified. Joan of Arc was canonized a saint in 1920 and named patron of France. Why it took over 500 years to canonize her is beyond me, but I'm sure is because she was a divisive person for a very long time. The British kings called themselves the King of France until 1801, and although they were Protestant, the British Empire was rapidly growing, and I'm sure the church didn't want to isolate the English world any more from her than it already was, or make life harder for the English Catholics. And perhaps I'm looking at this wrong. She is the patron saint of France. I'm not French. I am, in fact, part of the English world. She is also patron saint of people ridiculed for their piety, rape victims, and soldiers, especially female soldiers. None of that really fits me. Maybe the stuff I pray about is just not her thing. Regardless, Joan of Arc is one of the most fascinating people that ever lived, other than our Lord and our Lady, of course, and I will always admire her. Until my next video, God bless. If you like what you see, please like and share the video, and subscribe to the channel, turning on all notifications. If you would like to support this channel financially, please do so through Buy Me a Coffee. The link is in the description. It is unfortunately not tax deductible. Those who have bought coffees since the premiere of my last video and the recording of this one are Justin Simone, who said, "I'm grateful for your channel," and Nathan Webb, who said, "Thank you for reading through all the fine print and sorting through all the time-consuming details, then generously sharing the information with everyone on YouTube via interesting and entertaining videos." You can also like and follow us on Facebook. The link for that is also in the description.